Welcome to A Certain Age, a show for women who are unafraid to age out loud. Beauties, there are so many wonderful, fabulous things about being a podcaster. Sometimes you get invited to events or product launches or book parties. And when you hear a smart, fabulous woman, say an author, sharing funny stories and wise words about life, love, late blooming, and midlife reinvention, you can walk up to them during the cocktail hour and say, I have a podcast and I'd love to invite you to be a guest. And if you're lucky, they say yes. I feel lucky today to have had a yes from today's guest, writer Megan Tatey, author of the fresh, funny, delightful romance novel Super Bloom. Megan joins me to talk about her debut novel, love, loss, and the arc and evolution of a career that began in journalism. If you love storytelling and storytellers, stick around. This show is for you. Welcome, Megan.
Oh, thank you so much, Katie. I am so glad we met at that author event.
I know.
And that you approached me. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm not even kidding. It's like literally one of the best things about having a podcast, because I come across amazing women all the time, and it's just a great way to reach out and say, I'd love to connect and learn more. But so thank you for being a yes. I'm excited. And I want to ask you, many of the main characters in your book are writers, but one of them is a demanding and very sort of imperious best-selling romance writer by the name of Carmen Bronz. And at one point in the book, Carmen shares how much she hates doing press, right? After writing 34 books, people always ask the same question, which was, what was your inspiration for this novel? And I don't want to piss Carmen off, but I'm starting with the same question. What was the spark of the idea for Super Bloom?
That is so funny that you brought that up. I love it. And thanks for asking that. I don't tire of that question at all, unlike Carmen. So I think it was around 8 years ago that my husband took me on a surprise trip to Vermont to a spa for my birthday in February. I live in Western Massachusetts, and we zipped up there, and I was getting a massage from a very grumpy body worker. And she was maybe having a bad day, and my face was in the face cradle of the massage table, and she's sort of working on me. And the whole time I'm wondering, what is her story? You know, what's going on with her? I have a journalism background, like you said, and I have interviewed so many people over the years, and my inclination is to find out what someone's story is. So all these questions were rattling through my head. You know, what am I, her last client of the day? What was it like to work at that spa? Is she brokenhearted? And of course, all those questions are very inappropriate for her to like turn me over and start working on my feet and me to say, tell me everything. So I walked out of there, not necessarily with a great massage, but with this novel idea flooding through my head, casting her as a brokenhearted, downtrodden body worker who's, you know, about to lose her job and ends up having to sort of fight for it and also rediscover a hidden love of writing. And of course, in this scenario, I am Carmen Bronz. Carmen ends up being my character Joan's client, and she has to get a glowing review from her in order to keep her job. And Carmen wants all the dirt about the spa because she wants to set her bestseller there. So in this very like nascent moment, I'm Carmen wondering about all these things and left there thinking, I want to interview, you know, massage therapists. I want to find out what this job is really like. And that's what I ended up doing. I didn't end up talking with her, but I talked with lots of other people to begin to understand a really interesting, very unique industry.
And how did you source all of these massage, you know, therapists and body workers to be your kind of, you know, resource material? Where did you find them? Did you get a lot of massages, Megan?
I know people are like, did you go to so many spas? And I wish I did. I didn't. I first of all, just approached a friend, someone I knew. And at this point, I was just dipping a toe into fiction. And I had a lot of self-doubt about whether I could write a novel, whether I had it in me. And I always assumed my first book would be nonfiction. And I have my whole world has been steeped in writing and words, even from a young age. So But fiction still eluded me, and I felt like that belonged to someone else. And as I began to sort of craft this idea, I approached a friend, and it felt quite scary because it was sort of saying it out loud. I'm writing a novel. And those words felt absurd. Like it felt like, first of all, everyone's writing a novel, but no one's really writing a novel. And I felt sort of silly. And I had to be really vulnerable and say to this person, can I interview you? I'm at the very early stages of this book. And she said yes. And we had a great chat. I still have the notes from that first interview. And I was just really looking for, what do we not know about this really unique, quite intimate profession? You're in a tiny room with someone for 60 minutes or 90 minutes. You often don't know who you're going to get. It's very physically taxing. What we often are just concerned about the experience for ourselves, but what is it like to be the massage therapist? And what are the funny stories? What are the heartwarming stories? And a lot began to bubble up from that. And then I wanted to interview people who worked in a variety of settings, whether luxury spas, whether for yourself or some of these large franchises across the country, and people who felt disillusioned by that work and people who really loved it and felt fulfilled by it.
And I think you
And
capture that so well because the book
thank
is sort of
you.
peppered with experiences of the character Cher, for example, who really is committed and invested in the profession, and then the people who some of the blog posts that you share, some of the the research material surfaces up, kind of harrowing encounters that some of these massage, body workers go through with, very unfortunate clients. And I mean, Carmen Bronze almost winds up being like one of the nicer ones, even though she's a demanding taskmaster. Megan, I love
That
that
is
you,
really true.
it's so funny. I love also that you share that you felt silly at one point, sharing your vision for, novel writing with people in your life, because I can totally relate to that. I remember when I launched this podcast, I felt like kind of sheepish about like, hey, I'm a podcaster now. And it's like, really? Like, how do you get to, you're giving yourself permission to do something, and it can feel uncomfortable to tell people that you're switching into new lanes. And one of the reasons why I kind of stalked you at the Zibby Owens book party for you, with my glass of rosé in hand, is that you shared when you were on your panel that it took you 8 years to get Super Bloom from an idea, from an idea after a bad massage into a newly minted book. And I absolutely love this because we have like a semi-official motto over here, which is just bloom whenever the hell you feel like it. And I think there's a lot of people that think like you need to bloom at certain times, or that, there's like a timeline or a time frame. We have a lot of people who come on the show that describe themselves as late bloomers. Do you feel like a late bloomer, or do you feel like you are right on time?
That's a great question. And also I relate to you saying like, telling your family I'm a podcaster now. I think the people have asked, is it hard to do events and press around your book when you've been quietly writing a novel for years? And I think the hardest events are ones actually with friends and family who know me well, because I'm asking them to cast me in a different role now. I'm public speaking, I'm talking about being an author, and it feels more difficult to do that with people I know and love and who love me, because I'm asking them to suspend what they used to know and see me differently. So it's just kind of interesting side note. In terms of like blooming at different ages, so I'm 43 now, and I started the book in my mid-30s. And I think we are really hit over the head with overnight success stories, and that if we don't get picked up right away, whatever it is that we're sort of working on, that it means that we're talentless, and I was seeing like 18-year-old, is now an Oprah book pick. I'm like, oh God, I'm not 18. I'll never be an Oprah book pick. And it took a long time for me to realize that most authors have a novel or two in a drawer, And that the biggest thing that would help me on my journey was resilience and not giving up. So of course I wish I had sort of quote unquote bloomed earlier in some ways. Like I queried my book a year after writing it and heard, you know, nothing from,
crickets,
from
right?
agents. But also I really perfected my writing over the course of that 8 years. Zibi Books wasn't even a thing back then. So I'm so glad it took me as long as it did. And my title of the book is Super Bloom, which basically is the idea or this sort of phenomenon in nature that wildflower seeds lie dormant in deserts for years, waiting for the right conditions to bloom. And that they have these seeds of potential basically coiled inside of them. And when I learned about that, I think it was 2019, I was halfway into my years working on this book, and I heard an NPR story about super blooms, and I thought, what in the heck are those? And I looked them up and saw the pictures, and I knew instantly that that was the metaphor for my character. It would be the title for my book. And it was also what was happening for me, that I had had this sort of seed of potential for writing, waiting for these right conditions. And I'm so glad, I sort of feel so thankful to earlier iterations of myself that I didn't give up when it felt really hard, when I was facing a lot of rejection, when I didn't know what to do. So yes,
I love
sort of late bloomer, but yeah. Exactly.
I love that. It's also the whole concept of the super bloom is new to me. I learned about it in your book. I adore this notion of sort of dormancy and waiting for the right conditions. That's something that we talk about a lot in the show. Megan, we're heading into a quick break. When we come back, we're going to pick this up.
I am Patty Callahan Henry.
I am Mary Kay Andrews.
I'm Kristen Harbell.
And I'm Christy Whitson Harvey.
Friends in Fiction is led by four longtime friends, the four of us, with more than 75 published books between us.
Through in-depth conversations and interviews, we discuss the books we've written, the books we're reading, and the art of storytelling.
We're here with endless stories to support indie bookstores, authors, librarians, and readers just like you.
We are always seeking innovative ways to introduce dynamic voices and trends in publishing.
On this channel, you will find hundreds of episodes with some of your favorite authors, including the four of us with our new releases, as we reveal the stories behind the stories, offer writing tips, and talk about the creation of novels, memoirs, and nonfiction titles.
So, if you love books and you're curious about the writing world, you are in the right place.
You can listen to Friends and Fiction on any major streaming platform.
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read, a podcast about the books that built our souls. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. Don't miss it. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna to Jhumpa Lahiri, Susie Essman, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they talk, they share. You can join us on Instagram for more behind-the-scenes content and giveaways at You Are What You Read Podcast and at Adriana Trigiani. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We're back from the break. We went into it talking about this notion of super blooms, how we can lie dormant, you know, as sort of seeds of potential, waiting for conditions to occur that allow us to sort of bloom into our full selves. And this is a great segue into something I want to ask you about in your book. Because at one point in the book, Carmen, who's one of sort of the two main protagonists, and she's kind of an anti-heroine, but she says something in the book that begins to, I think, endear her to readers, because at least it started to endear her to me. She says about the women in her own romance books, quote, "My heroine, she doesn't shy away from her wants, her needs, her most base desire. She grabs them, snatches them as if it's a case of life or death. And then she goes on to say, we can't get enough of it because we rarely see it in our own lives. Many women walk around experiencing a slow spiritual death. The women in my books reckon with that. They face those dark thoughts of loneliness, despair, of life without passion, and they make a different decision. The women in my novels do the most revolutionary act. They are their true selves. Why do you think it is so hard for women to be their true selves?
Oh, first of all, it's such a delight to hear my words read back to me. It's just so fun. So thank you. And thank you for choosing that passage. I really love that. I'll answer this in two ways. First of all, when I was creating Carmen and creating her as a romance character, a romance writer, at first, you know, this is a comedic novel in a lot of ways. And at first, I was choosing romance novelist sort of as a lark, thinking this would be so funny. And it had been years since I had read romance myself. And so I was like, you know, I should probably read some romance novels. I should listen to romance writers. And I should just really kind of dive deep. And I'm so glad I did. The genre is much more feminist than it has been in years. It's doing really innovative things. It's incredibly hard to write, as Carmen says at one point. And I had to re-kind of fashion the way I was approaching her so that even in moments where I'm kind of poking fun at romance novel names and things like that, that I was also showing a lot of respect for what she does and the craft and the genre. And that women are turning to these books, I think, because they don't often get a chance to be their true selves in real life. We have so many sort of pressures put upon us, whether it's motherhood and balancing, as you know, the career and working. And kind of, I think when I became a mom, I had this this idea that, you know, you can have it all. You know, we're kind of told that. And when I found myself struggling to have it all and to hold it all at one time, I began to feel like I was the failure. And then I began to realize, oh, it's the message that's the failure. There's no way I can, there's so many hours, only so many hours in one day. There's no way I can do every single thing. I can't fulfill myself creatively. I can't do my career. I can't fold the laundry. I can't exercise, you know, spend time with my dog and do well by my husband and children, you know, all in one day. And so I think we just have so many pressures. And out of that, we're also trying to figure out who is our true self when we're facing these messages of perfection. And sometimes the true self isn't that perfect model, right? Like it's,
yeah, perfectionism. Exactly. There's right. We're measuring ourselves against an absolutely impossible measuring stick, where people are doing everything right. So I love this idea of message is the failure. I would also like add to that and say it's the systems that are the failure as well. I mean, we like, you know, we are placed in you know, work and community systems that aren't always supportive of women. We don't have paid childcare, and child leave in this country. I'm like, my brain is not working right now, but you know what I mean. Like, we are expected to do everything in a place that's not supporting that in many key and fundamental ways. So it does make it tricky. Do you feel that as you've aged, though, it's easier to be your truer self? I mean, it allowed you particularly stepped into a new role and allowed yourself to feel silly, or to, as you said, you sort of cast yourself in a new role in your life, that it was sort of hard to maybe do that in front of your family. But did getting to midlife in any way make it easier to assume this new identity or to feel truer to yourself?
I think it has. And I think I've started to be really careful around language that I use with my writing. And what I mean by that is, and maybe you can relate to this, but I think women, a lot of times, even when we're communicating with each other, we'll use the word sneaking out, or sneaking. Can you sneak this in? Can you sneak to this event with me? And I often use that wording around my writing. Like, I'm going to sneak in a little bit of writing. And I think that saying devalues what the writing is, devalues your social life, if that's how you're using it, makes it almost seem like it's not allowed. Like there's something kind of criminal even about it. I'm going to sneak away from my family. Otherwise, I'm not allowed to do it unless I can kind of, you know, get out in the cover of darkness or get this writing done behind their backs, behind a closed door very quickly. And it wasn't like I had a very conscious conversation with my husband, who's really supportive, and my kids are also really supportive. But I began to notice that the writing was happening on the edges and fringes of my life. And that's also why it took me so long. And I began to say very clearly to my family, it's a Sunday and I'm going to my studio and I'm writing from 1 to 3 and I'm very open about it, you know, and I would say to my kids, mom's writing, or, oh, you guys, hold on. I have an idea about a chapter. I need to go upstairs and I'm going to do some writing. And that sort of just opened it up for me, for my family. It put a new value on it. And it put a value on being in my imagination, right? Because some of this work is unseen. The work of writing isn't just sitting at my computer, moving my fingers over my keyboard. A lot of it is thinking. And it seems like, what's mom doing? Why is she standing at that window? It's sort of this unseen sort of work, but we have to value it. And I wanted to talk about it really openly, and begin to pivot my family to making it very central to our lives. And we've done that now. And I think that also has come with age and me feeling more confident to say, this is who I am. This is what I want to do. And going back to like my true self, this is my true self. It's what I love. And my days are better. I'm a better mom, a better partner, a better person standing at the bank with more patience when I've touched the page in some way. And our whole family is now sort of rallying around that, which felt really crucial. So no more sneaking around. Like, don't use that language anymore.
This is so intriguing. I have a good friend who does a lot of high level coaching at organizations, and one of the fundamental tenets to shifting behaviors and driving outcomes is declaring a vision. And they use that word deliberately. I've heard her talk about this. You have to declare what it is you want to do. You claim it publicly in order to breathe it into existence, right? It can't happen just, like as you said, on the fringes. And so I love hearing you talk about how to articulate the value of the work that you're doing in a way that was understandable to both yourself and to the people in your life that are going to be necessary to help you support that. And I think that's such a powerful sort of offering to our listeners, because everyone who's listening to this has a long simmering desire that they would like to do. And that this notion of declaring something, I feel, is so powerful. Tell me a little bit about your children. Are they excited to see your book out in the world? Have they been able to enjoy your book events? Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, they love it. So they're 4 and 7, so they're still quite young. And I've been writing this book the entire time my daughter and son have been born, alive. And
wow.
They have seen the thing that really makes me proud about this is they've seen me work so hard at something. They've seen the grind, and they've seen me cry over it. They've seen me, get rejected. They used to march around the house saying, if you don't like mom's book, we're going to kick you. they watched all these ups and downs. And while they couldn't totally grasp all of it, they saw that I was working really hard. And then, of course, when I got the book deal, they were like, well, where's the book? They're like, it's coming. It takes a while. And when I did my unboxing of my books, I mean, they are just so thrilled to hold it and see it and see the tangibleness. And it just, oh gosh. I mean, my daughter, just last weekend, we were at a restaurant and my daughter was like, "Mom, are you going to tell them who you are?"
Oh my God, I love it.
I'm like, "No, honey, no, no." So she's there. So
she's like,
excited.
"My mom's Beyonce."
Yeah, they're. I'm like, "I don't think they know."
I know, but she's.
They know.
No, they know you're. You know, they know how hard you worked, and you're a superstar to them, and it's so exciting that they get to see that kind of energy. I know sometimes your kids are so much younger. I didn't realize that mine. Mine are 23, 20, and 16, and I. When you were talking about the early days of new motherhood, I mean, I still feel, I remember that stuff very presently, like how overwhelming it is to be sort of tossed into the ocean of new motherhood and to kind of keep up with it. And, you know, but I remember it sort of feeling like inadequate in so many ways, because we're measuring ourselves against a very false yardstick. About what it means to be a good mother. But I feel like I've sort of evolved and I've gotten so much more confident in it. But a big part of it is recognizing that you need to model things for your children that, and you're doing that, you know, that they see work, that they see passion, that they see, you know, upset feelings, and that they see like results. And it's so good. And sometimes when we're brand new moms, we don't allow ourselves to do those things. So I love
one
that.
One of the things I found the most startling in new motherhood that I think no one can prepare you for is the amount of mental space being a mom takes up that you have to sort of shift everything else to the side for. And I'm talking about holding things in your mind like camp forms and shoe sizes that for fall they're gonna need this, you know, and like
right, buying all this, buying the snow boots before they sell out, because you gotta buy them way before the snow ever shows up, right?
And the vigilance on that level, beyond taking just like physical care of them, the vigilance of like every aspect, that really, no matter, I mean, I have a very supportive, wonderful partner, but there are some things that just really seem to fall on the mom that I just wasn't prepared for the mental space that was going to take up, that I'd have to shove so much to the side to really hold on to that. And, you know, and then things fall through and you're like, "Oh, you feel terrible. I forgot the bug spray," you know, just, and you just kind of put yourself through the ringer about those things. And it's hard to keep your passions and creativity going when you're, you know, working on that level. It's really tough.
Yeah, absolutely. And you eventually get space. You know, I'm in the phase of life where I'm getting a lot of space. My children have fewer needs and are, you know, more self-sufficient, and, you know, I enjoy them in new ways, and it's more of a consultant role than it is like a direct manager, which is so much better. But, you know, I'm in the phase now where I have an aging parent that has a lot of recent health issues, and that's challenging in a new way. And so I've had several weeks where, again, it's all consuming. So it's interesting. It's that whole sort of sandwich generation. It's just part of life going through. There's no cure for being human. We have to manage all these different things. So speaking of no cure for being human, you know, your book touches on a lot of different themes. It's, you know, it's on its surface, it's a love story. It's also about loss and grief. It's about finding oneself, rediscovering passions as Joan kind of resurrects her love for writing. It's about friendship. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is one of the friendship moments that happens in the book. And this really spoke to me. It's when Cher, who's one of the characters, and Joan are struggling, right? Their friendship's faltering at one point in the book, and they are able to sort of breathe new life into it through a really honest conversation about hurt feelings. And I love this particular moment in the book. And it really spoke to me, I think, because of what I do on the podcast. I feel like having honest conversations is so transformative, and it can be so hard to do. You know, was this something that you put in place deliberately? Tell me a little bit about what you think the role of honest conversations is in this particular book, and maybe in your own life.
I'm so glad you like that chapter. It's actually one of my favorite chapters of the book. And I wanted to explore, they've been friends for years. And basically, you know, for people who don't know about what the book is about, Joan is grieving the loss of her boyfriend, Samuel. It's been 2 years now, and they were only together for 6 months, but it was sort of an epic 6 months. And her best friend, Cher, is sort of like, you got to move on. You know, she's worried about her. And her way of sort of showing this worry is to be like, you didn't know each other for that long. You're spinning your wheels. I need you to move on. And Joan is so heartbroken by that approach. And I wanted to show, first of all, that Cher is well-meaning. You know, she is worried about her friend, but she's not necessarily able to express it in the right way. And everyone has a different response to a loved one grieving, especially when they've been grieving for a long time. And also, I've definitely had friendships where suddenly you're texting passive-aggressive emojis to each other, but you can't remember why. You know, and it's like, it's been months and your text messages are getting more and more sort of curt and weird and passive aggressive and like happy face, winky face. And suddenly you look up and you're sort of like, well, what is the problem? I think it's very rare that we have these honest conversations with our friends. We often do these, you know, these conversations with our partners. But to have a sort of resetting and a reshuffling with a friend, I think is kind of rare, but very needed. So I wanted to sort of show that happening and have Cher and Joan kind of come back together. And at first are kind of sparring over the surface of what feels like is going on. But when they dig a little deeper, they find there's a lot of hurt underneath that's gone on for quite some time. And misunderstanding, and it allows them to sort of come together and reset their friendship and kind of put it on a new track. And I've had opportunities to do that with friends, and it feels so scary. It feels so vulnerable, more vulnerable than with, you know, love with like a partner, because it's, we just don't see it as often. We don't do it as much. And it feels kind of strange.
Yeah, absolutely. I've done the same thing myself, which is probably why I was intrigued by this. And I have such wonderful friends in my life. I've had friends that I met when I was in fifth grade, when I was 10, to, you know, friends that I met 10 years ago that are so close to me. And I just this chapter just really spoke to me because of that. And I am excited. I'm going to be having a wonderful guest on the show in a couple of months, Laura Tremaine, who wrote the book. She's written several books, but she'll come on to talk about her book, Life Counsel, which is all about female friendship. So I'm really excited to explore that with her. And I was curious about this. But the notion, too, of this honest conversation as a reset, I think is something that I personally have gotten better at in midlife, you know, having those harder conversations and just being more honest. So it was fun to see it play out in this chapter. And I was just curious about what role, you know, if any, you have, you know, it's played in your own life.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, I've had friendships where, gosh, you know, you're kind of asking a close friend to do the work with you, to take your friendship to a new level. And that is, again, kind of scary, because what if that friend doesn't want to, or doesn't see a problem, doesn't want to go that deep with you, or, you know, doesn't view you as that type of friend. So it's a kind of scary thing to ask another person to do. And I've definitely done that with friends, or had moments where you come together as friends and you say, this isn't quite working. You know, maybe we're better off as friends on the periphery. You know, we're not as close as we once were, and that's okay. And again, very, very vulnerable, takes a lot of bravery, but I think clearing the air is just, it feels so good afterwards, right? Like it just like kind of cleanses you. So I'll be interested to hear that podcast as well, because I have had a lot of, you know, varied experiences in this realm.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. I'm really looking forward to it. So this book is just full of wonderful themes. It was really such a joy to read. It does have a vein of comedy that runs through it. You said it was meant to be a comedic novel, and it is. It's romance. It's you know, it checks a lot of boxes. I so enjoyed it. We're going to be heading into our speed round in just a few minutes. But before we go, I do want to just ask a quick question about like process, because I know people are always curious, myself included. You know, what, you know, it took you 8 years to write this book. It happened a little bit on the fringes, but maybe walk us through how did it solidify? Like, did you do it all by yourself? Were you in a writing group? How did you get your, you know, your agent and your publisher? And maybe give us a little quick snapshot of how that worked.
I think it was 2019 that I really doubled down on the novel, and I said, okay, I'm getting close, but it's not quite there. And I had a lot of agent rejections, but a lot of great bites. And so I took another writing class. I joined a writing group that was instrumental to getting my book in tip-top shape. I got a rejection from my now agent, who sent me the most amazing rejection letter and with some feedback in it. And I, of course, I cried. And then the next day I took it to my writing group. And I spent the next 10 months tweaking the book again. And I went back to that agent the following fall and I said, would you read this again? And she said, I'm so happy to see you. Yes, send it to me. I sent it to her. And in the meantime, I saw Zibby Books was starting their imprint and I was really excited about it. I'd been watching Zibby Owens and her podcast for a long time. And so this was about 4 months after my agent looked at my manuscript again and was considering it. And so I had a connection to Zibby Books, an introduction, which is always helpful in publishing. And 6 weeks after that, Zibby acquired my novel and I got my agent the next day. And the whole thing came together in 1 week after 7 years of working on it. So it was a very exciting week.
It's such a fabulous story. And it's just such a testament to this notion of like resilience, which you touched on, you know, that and grit and tenacity and, you know, evolving and iterating and sort of that try again. And it produced Super Bloom, such an enjoyable, beautiful book. I encourage everyone who's listening to check it out, add it to your beach bag this summer. I really thoroughly enjoyed it. So we're heading into our speed round, Megan, and we always close the show with this. It's just a quick 1 to 2 word answer so we can end on a high energy note. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let's do it. Okay. Writing Super Bloom was?
Oh, endlessly fun.
The first time you saw Super Bloom on a bookstore shelf or on a Amazon page, how did it feel?
I was elated.
Nice.
Elated. Yep.
Elated is a good word and a good feeling. Writing is a solitary sport. What gives you a sense of community as a writer?
Texting my writing group in the midst of it.
Nice. Longhand or computer?
Oh, computer.
Your characters write in longhand notebooks, though, so I was curious.
They do.
What's harder, writing or editing?
Writing.
The character in the book you most identify with?
Joan.
What book or books is on the top of your to-be-read pile this summer?
I'm looking at one right now, The Marriage Portrait.
Nice. Okay. Who is an author that does rom-coms right?
Emily Henry.
Who is an author that captures midlife women well?
Oh, gosh. I'm blanking. I don't know.
It's that midlife brain fog. Sometimes it's hard to pull these things out of your.
I'm gonna like think of 12 as soon as we get off.
And you can text me. I'll put them into the show notes. Okay. Finally, your one word answer to complete the sentence. As I age, I feel
wiser.
Nice. Thank you, Megan. This was so much fun. Before we say goodbye, how can our listeners find you, your writing, and Super Bloom?
Thank you for having me on. You can find me at megantatey.com. I'm on Instagram at megtatey, and my books are everywhere. Books are sold.
Phenomenal. This wraps A Certain Age, a show for women who are aging without apology. Want more of A Certain Age? Sign up for our newsletter, Age Boldly, over on our website, acertainagepod.com, or follow us on Instagram at acertainagepod. We share bonus content, giveaways, links, and midlife resources. Come hang out. Special thanks to Michael Mancini, who composed and produced our theme music. See you next time. And until then, age boldly, beauties.